You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Welcome to Brookings. Please have a seat. Thank you for coming for this very special occasion. I'm Mauricio Cárdenas, the director of the Latin America Initiative here at the Brookings Institution and also a senior fellow. It gives me a great honor and great pleasure to welcome Prime Minister Bruce Golding from Jamaica. The Prime Minister is on a trip to Washington to talk primarily about economic and development issues, and we thought it was a great opportunity to invite him to visit us here at Brookings to talk about the issues of the day for his country and for the region in general. As you know, here at the Brookings Institution, we're very interested in promoting better policies, better engagement, a new partnership between the United States and the rest of this hemisphere. And we take very seriously the issue of working for the benefit and in the interest of the people of the Caribbean. Many of the topics that we cover and the issues that we discuss on a regular basis have to do with the crucial topics of development for countries like Jamaica. The Prime Minister is a long career in politics in his country. He's a man of short introductions, and I am thankful to him for that. I'm going to be very brief in just reminding you that he's been Prime Minister since September 11, 2007, and has a long career, a very distinguished career, in public service in his country, having been Minister of Public Works, having been the leader of the opposition when his party, Jamaica's Labour Party, was not in government. He was, in still is, has the record of having been the youngest member of the parliament at age 24. I think that's also a very distinguished element and perhaps a motivating force for those of you that are students, interns, and research assistants here at Brookings. Prime Minister, it is a great honor. We hope to have, as we usually have, a very lively conversation after your remarks, based on your questions, your comments, and a dialogue that we'll have with the Prime Minister. So welcome to Brookings, and I hope this visit to Washington is a fruitful and successful one. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cárdenas. And let me also express my thanks for the opportunity to address this auspicious institution. The primary reason for my being in Washington this week is to address a special investors forum which is being held by the IDB on Thursday. I've taken the opportunity as well to have discussions with the IMF and with the World Bank and the IDB, our international development partners. I mention that only for the purpose of putting in context the remarks that I propose to make today. Let me talk a little bit about Jamaica, where it is and where it has been. Prior to the global recession, Jamaica faced significant economic challenges. We had recorded very anemic growth over a period of 17 years prior to the recession. We were not enjoying any robust growth even when the rest of the world and most of the developing countries were enjoying growth during the boom time of the 1990s and coming into the new millennium. When I took office, we inherited 14 consecutive years of fiscal deficits. We have had, over a prolonged period of time, very high interest rates, ranging at times from 16% at the low end to as high as 32% We have accumulated a huge national debt. The cost to service that debt bears down heavily on our annual budgets, compressing the space that we have for critical expenditure in education, in health, in infrastructure, and so on. In order to support that high level of indebtedness, we have had to maintain high levels of taxes, very unevenly spread, so that it bears down heavily on some and it virtually releases from any burden many others. We have had, as some of you probably know, a high level of crime in Jamaica, including high homicide rates. Now, I don't come here to blame anyone for that. I believe that a substantial part of our predicament was caused by bad policy decisions over many, many years. But having said that, as the state of affairs when the recession hit us, you can well imagine the impact that that recession had on Jamaica, the impact that it had in cutting our export demand. Three of our four alumina refineries were shut down, and bauxite alumina accounted for more than 50% of our total export earnings. You can imagine the trauma that that by itself created. The capital markets on which we had placed increasing reliance virtually dried up, creating a significant balance of payments problem. Investment flows as well from foreign direct investment virtually disappeared. Tourism, one of our main industries, faced significant struggles. I think we have done well during the crisis, but it had to contend with the significant fall off in tourist traffic around the world. And all of this, of course, led to significant job losses, significant economic contraction. We went through 13 consecutive quarters of economic decline. There's a peculiar thing about crises. They often turn options into imperatives, and that was the case with Jamaica. We engaged the IMF, the World Bank, and the IDB. We developed an economic program, which is ours, not theirs. We designed that program, but we sought their support. It's a program that involves stringent fiscal containment. We had to impose a wage freeze on public sector wages. We had to do something that we had never done before. We entered into a debt exchange program to deal with our domestic debt, which was the most burdensome part of our debt portfolio. It's something that had never been done before, and there was great trepidation when we indicated that that is what we had to do. It turned out to be, up to now, the most successful debt exchange program the world has ever seen. We had a almost 98% subscription. We have instituted significant reforms, institutional reforms, to create fiscal sustainability through legislation that will put serious strictures on our deficit and on our accumulation of debt and move it away from just government's own decision and to subject it to significant parliamentary oversight. I indeed want to go further. I want to put it in the Constitution and place significant limits with provision, of course, that in extraordinary circumstances with the approval of Parliament, those limits can be exceeded. We have sought to consolidate government's accounts because we were operating with so many different accounts, we didn't even know how much money government had, and I suspect how much money government owed. We found ourselves in a peculiar position where we were sometimes borrowing money from ourselves and paying high interest rates for the money we were borrowing. We have sought to brought all of that together. We have established a central treasury management system so that we can have on one frame a clear picture as to the state of government's accounts. We tabled in Parliament last month, a major program of tax reform, perhaps the most significant tax reform proposal that the country has ever seen. And we have set January 1 as the date for full rollout of that. We're going to be subjecting it to discussions, which have already been underway, but wider discussions among the public so that there's a clear understanding of the philosophy that is informing that approach. We have completed, after 1 year of intense work, a major restructuring of the public sector, collapsing some government agencies, merging others, redefining purpose and functions, and realigning functions with authority. We have embarked on a significant program of privatization. We have successfully privatized now the national airline, something that the previous government had sought to do and made one attempt, which ended up with it ownership reverting back to government. We have concluded that privatization. We will, as of next month, be handing over control and to a large extent, ownership of our sugar industry. Our government still operates 5 sugar factories, and we will be divesting ourselves to a company out of China. We are well advanced in the divestment of government's ownership of the alumina refinery, which government still has 45% equity in. We are proceeding with plans to privatize the Norman Manley International Airport, and we are developing plans to privatize the management of the Port of Kingston, so that we are proceeding on a basis where we're trying to return government to its essential core functions and to leave to the private sector those things that are more suited for private sector investment and management. We're doing some other things. We're embarking on a program of good governance, instituting a number of critical measures, because we recognize that that too is important in supporting our hopes and plans for economic development. We have passed a constitutional amendment establishing a new charter of fundamental rights and freedoms. We have established an independent commission of investigations to deal with instances of abuse by agents of the state, particularly the security forces, because we do have a blemish record as far as that is concerned. We are proceeding now with legislation to criminalize certain breaches of the process by which government contracts are awarded. We have before Parliament, as we speak, special legislation to establish the Office of Special Prosecutor, who will be required to concentrate on investigating and prosecuting instances of corruption among public officers. We have already enacted in law whistleblower legislation to strengthen the capacity of civil society, the individual citizens, to become sentries, to become watchdogs, and to be able to report and disclose with greater confidence instances of wrongdoing. We have before Parliament as well legislation to reform our defamation laws and to bring them somewhat more in line with what exists in the United States, because the laws as they exist at the moment provide a virtual firewall to scoundrels who can use defamation laws to prevent exposure of the wrongdoing that they may be involved in. We are enacting into law certain provisions of the Code of Political Conduct with severe sanctions to punish politicians who breach what we consider to be critical provisions of that code. We are putting in place arrangements for parliamentary scrutiny of sensitive government appointments, somewhat akin to the congressional hearings that are held in the United States. I have brought before Parliament, and awaiting final debate and passage, a bill to impose term limits on the office of Prime Minister, something that I think is important to allow for renewal and to ensure that no one feels that the position of Prime Minister is some heritage or some entitlement that one must strive at all costs and for as long as necessary to hold on to. We have made some significant improvements in terms of the management of crime. Last year, with much resistance, we enacted 6 critical pieces of legislation to strengthen the powers of the security forces to deal with crime. We are currently working on a major piece of legislation to deal with organized crime, because our laws see crime as essentially an individual thing, and our laws are not adequate to deal with organized criminal activities, and we hope to have before Cabinet the final draft legislation that will then go on to Parliament. Last year, we mounted a significant assault on criminal activity in Jamaica, and it has produced significant results. We don't sing our praises yet because it is still a work in progress, but all put together, these measures are producing results that are encouraging, but results that will require sustained effort in order to consolidate them. We enjoy a stable exchange rate. Our net international reserves are the highest that they have ever been. Our inflation is moderating. We are back in single-digit inflation, and we expect this year to emerge at somewhere just around 6% inflation. I mentioned before that we had been through 13 consecutive quarters of economic decline. The results for the first quarter of this year indicate, for the first time in that period, we have now recorded growth. And the indications are that that trend is going to continue and be strengthened in the current quarter and beyond. The employment data for April, we do employment surveys 4 times a year, and the most recent survey in April indicated that our employment has begun to rise once again, our employment levels. But as I said, we're not yet out of the woods. We're going to have to be firm, be steadfast in implementing all of these measures. As I said before, some of them, we are determined to institutionalize them through legislation and even through constitutional amendments. And we're going to have to ensure that we provide the fortitude and the strength and the commitment to protect this process from the vagaries of competitive politics. We have an election due by September of next year, and it is so important for us to make sure that the pressures that may attend, the political imperatives of that election, are not allowed in any way to derail the program that we are on. We have seen encouraging signs of strengthening confidence among the private sector, and we are beginning to see that reflected in terms of commitment to investment, the rollout of projects. Let me say, and I want to move toward the more general issue and the concerns that I want to invite you to think about and perhaps help me to explore and promote. The predicament from which we are beginning to emerge is not dissimilar to that which affects most Caribbean countries. And in all of those cases, that predicament was aggravated by the impact of the global recession. The plight of Caribbean countries is masked to some extent, indeed to a great extent, by the classification that is applied to us, that we are middle-income countries. And if you look at the raw data, it would suggest that most of the countries in the Caribbean have done, relatively speaking, not too badly. We have a good tourism sector. We have been able to attract over many years a fairly steady flow of foreign investment. We have benefited from the earnings that and the earnings that flow and the employment that is created from the production and export of primary products such as sugar and bananas. But you know, therein lies our vulnerability, because we are, as a group of countries, severely exposed to exogenous shocks, both external and internal. We are small, tiny economies. Our domestic markets are just too small to support the sustained level of economic growth that we need. And therefore, we have to depend on the expanded space, the external markets, to provide us with the room that we need to grow. But therein lies a major challenge, because those are markets in which the competition is ferocious, and many of us have been found wanting in being able to be globally competitive. Those countries that have depended and still depend on primary exports as a significant part of their economic base are faced with a crisis, because they have maintained those industries on the basis of preferential arrangements. We have long lost our competitive advantage there, and we have been able to stay in business only because of the preferential arrangements offered largely by Europe and to some extent by the United States, but those have all but disappeared. We are required, under new world trading rules, we are required to progressively liberalize our tariffs, which means that our markets are now far more open to imports from developed countries. And while we are told that their markets are equally open to us, some are more equal than others, because we just don't have the competitive ability to penetrate those markets. Foreign investment flows, on which we depend so heavily, depends on what is happening in the major markets of the world. And when the recession hit, that pipe virtually was closed. And then we faced another problem, and that is the risk of natural disasters. Now, bear in mind, we're small island states. Look at the damage that was done by Katrina in Louisiana. Look at the damage that was done recently in Joplin, Missouri. But that's just a part of the United States, and the rest of the United States is able to respond and to ensure that recovery proceeds almost instantaneously. In 2004, when Hurricane Ivan hit Grenada, it virtually wiped out the country. I mean, it virtually erased 10 years of economic growth that had been achieved with great effort and with great sacrifice. And therefore, we are particularly in a particularly sensitive position, because we may take five steps forward and a hurricane that sits on us or passes over us for no more than an hour and a half can set us back 10 or 15 years. And therefore, Caribbean countries continuously find themselves living on the edge, where we're struggling to improve the standard of living of our people, but so often see the gains that are made so easily eroded, and then finding ourselves having to fight back to virtually start all over again. And in doing so, in riding these turbulent waves, we have accumulated huge public debt, because we have so often had to borrow to fill these gaps. And with those huge debts, we are left with so little fiscal space to do the critical things, the infrastructure, the critical services in education and health and so on, that we are required to do. The classification given to us by the international agencies deprives us of the opportunity of debt forgiveness. Highly indebted poor countries, majority of them located in Africa, benefited from this. If you look at the economies of, say, Tanzania and Uganda, you will see the strides that they have been able to make, having benefited from debt forgiveness, but in addition, having aligned with that debt forgiveness the pursuit of sound economic and fiscal policies. I had hoped that the economic crisis that we have been going through, the onset of it, I had hoped that we would have seen a review and a restructuring of the global financial architecture with an emphasis on development, and I will explain briefly why that dimension is so important. I had hoped that the powers that make decisions that affect in such a significant way the fortunes of countries like my own would have recognized that while the problem may have originated in the capital markets of the developed countries, the long-term solution must include addressing the imbalances in the global economy and the development deficit of the more than 60% of the world's population, for which globalization, instead of being a stepping stone, has proven to be a hindrance. And even while I say that, we can't discount the value of the assistance provided by institutions such as the World Bank and the development banks, in our case, the Inter-American Development Bank. And yet there's an important dimension that the global financial system has not accepted, and I'm not even sure if it fully recognizes it. Let us note that despite the significant economic growth that took place in the world for the 2 decades leading up to the recession, wealth creation and purchasing power still remained highly concentrated in the developed countries. Technology has been advancing, continues to advance at such mind-boggling pace, and what it is doing is creating new products which have their own demand. But I suggest that we must not assume that the ability of people in the developed countries to consume is infinite. At a certain point, they have virtually consumed all that there is to be consumed. And I think that if we want to see an instance of that, I believe that it can be found in the financial bubble that has taken place, particularly in the United States, where in order to pursue demand, we were creating affordability where affordability didn't exist, simply because markets had to be found for these things that were being produced, whether it was houses or cars or whatever. And hence you ended up with this huge crisis for which even countries like mine that didn't contribute significantly to that crisis are now paying. If the production capacity of the developed world is outpacing its ability to consume, its consumption capacity, it will simply need to extend its markets. And that extension of its markets has to come from the developing countries. Their ability to consume is inextricably tied with the market expansion that the developed world requires. But the ability of these countries, these developing countries, to consume is restricted by their own economic circumstances, their own development deficit. It stands to reason that if the standard of living in developing countries is raised, the demand for the output for the goods produced by developed countries, the machinery to make them, the jobs that the making of them will entail, will also be raised. I mean, it's pretty logical that if more people in Jamaica and in the Caribbean and in Africa and in Asia are able to afford the effective demand for motor cars and television sets and things like that, that the developed countries are going to benefit. I mean, that's their market. That's the expanded market that they are going to need to sustain the high level of production that they have developed. And it seems to me, therefore, that in the face of the symmetry that globalization espouses, there is an asymmetrical development-oriented strategy that needs to be embraced if we are to grow the global economy in a way that can be sustained. and in a way that can ensure financial stability over the long term. I submit that developed countries have a far greater interest than is currently being shown in stimulating and investing in the development of countries like mine. We have already seen the impact that improved incomes in countries like China and India and Brazil. We have already seen the impact that that can have on demand, on increasing demand. Even that hurts us because with that increased demand comes higher prices that countries like Jamaica have to contend with. The thing with countries like India and China and Brazil is that their domestic economies are large enough to provide some of their own stimulus. Mine isn't. Some developing countries are making that transition. You think of countries like Peru, where they're moving from developing to emerging and en route to becoming developed countries. But they still represent a minority. And the fear that I have, which I hope will not be realized, is that globalization, if left in its raw, pure form, may well result in a revised delineation of the world, but one in which some countries, albeit a few more than was the case before, some countries will be developed, but the majority of countries will remain confined to struggle with poverty and underdevelopment. I think the current global crisis provides an opportunity to address that issue, to seek to focus and to change that imbalance. It's a small window of opportunity because so many of the developed countries are preoccupied with their own economic challenges. And it is an opportunity that will disappear once the global economy returns to some semblance of stability, even if that stability is only for a time. The Brookings Institution has distinguished itself and has a remarkable track record in stimulating discussions, even when those discussions appear to be swimming against the tide. And some of the discussions that you have fostered have led to critical policy initiatives that have changed the way that powerful decision makers think and ultimately make their decisions. My hope is that this issue that I have sought to raise will become one of your successes. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Prime Minister. You're absolutely right. Think tanks are in the business of thinking and thinking about hard and difficult issues. And the issues of development, and especially of development of countries like yours, are challenging. And they require tremendous vision and political leadership. I think the essence of your message is that a middle-income country that, for reasons that will be too long to elaborate, inherits a quite significant debt that is forced in a way to adjust at a time when the global economy has not fully recovered, that it's not well endowed in the natural resources that are making countries, say, in South America and other parts of the world, booming, like minerals or oil or commodities prices that are going up, and at the same time is more dependent on the economy of the United States for the tourism, for the remittances. It's in a difficult position. And we're in the business of trying to find alternatives and ideas. And that's in that context is that your view that the world needs to take into account the situation of these economies and find ways helping is a very important one. My own personal view is that the future of Jamaica, of course, will depend on strengthening what is already a great comparative advantage in the field of tourism, in agricultural production, as you mentioned, in the case of sugar. But Jamaica is also in a unique position to be a very important provider of renewable energies, which is it's now more important than ever for countries like the United States. And when you look, for example, at the recent decision by the German government of shutting out all the operations of their nuclear facilities, it is the time and the era for alternative sources of energy. And Jamaica is in a unique position, I repeat, to play an important role in that process, not only because of the production of sugar, which can be converted into ethanol, but also because of the importance of developing its comparative advantage in solar and wind energy. So this is an important element. But of course, Jamaica alone cannot do it. This is technologically very challenging. It's a very costly process, and it needs a lot of support. And it's in that process and in that claim that we think that could be a nice convergence between the initiatives of the White House, the environment, the Energy and Climate Partnership for the Americas, the initiatives of the Department of Energy, and the needs for development of countries like Jamaica. But those are ideas that we need to develop a little bit more so that they can become practical and they can become adopted by leaders like you. And it's in that process that we'd like to spend more time discussing. But let me open now the floor to take some of your comments and questions. Be very brief, if you will, and please introduce yourself as well. So we have one person here and two gentlemen right here.
Yes. Yes, good morning, Virginia Monte for Agency France Press. Talking about natural disaster, we have heavy rains and flooding in Haiti with at least 10 persons dead. How is it in Jamaica?
Well, just as we speak, we have been undergoing what is now almost a week of constant rains, not hurricane level rains, but constant enough to create significant damage, and that illustrates the kind of vulnerability that we suffer from. It's too early yet to give you some indication as to what the total impact is going to be. At the end of it, we're going to have to pick up that cost, and we're going to have to find some way, some space, to respond to those needs, the repairs that have to be done. But we do that at a price. It means that we're going to have to shift resources from other critical areas in order to respond to that. You mentioned Haiti. Haiti needs all the assistance that we can provide, not only because of the extent of the devastation that they have suffered, but also because of the significant limitations that they experience in terms of their capacity to do things, their institutional capacity. And I don't think time will allow for any long-term institutional capacity building, important though that is, and that has to be done. I think an emergency response is going to have to be provided to send people in there. We have offered, for example, we don't have money to offer, but we have offered to send our urban planners, our architects, our engineers in there who can assist them to just get projects going, start getting the schools rebuilt, start getting houses built for the people and so on. But they deserve all the assistance that they can get.
My name is Ransford Palmer, and I'm a professor at Howard University. In recent times, remittances from immigrants in this country have become a most important source of foreign exchange for Jamaica.
Absolutely.
And I'm wondering if you've ever given any thought to diverting some of those remittances to investment, because most of it goes to consumption. Have you ever given any thought to...
Yes, we have. In fact, right now we're designing an instrument that we hope to offer to the diaspora which would represent an education bond, an investment in the development of educational institutions and so on. The Minister of Housing also wants to offer a bond that would enable people to buy into that bond with the ultimate aim and objective being that when they decide to return home, that bond is converted into a house that they could return. I have to be restraining him because we don't want to hit the diaspora with too many instruments at the same time. But yes, we have. We have been pursuing it. One of the things that you have to bear in mind, though, is that a significant part, and I would never attempt to even measure it because I guessed what it might be because we have never measured it, a significant part of the remittances that come home for the very reason you have cited, come home to assist the consumption needs of families. People sending money home for their aging parents, their children, their families, and so on. That is going to be very difficult to divert because that's the need. That's what triggered it in the first place. But I do agree that there are many Jamaicans abroad who are so passionate about their homeland that they are anxious to own more a piece of the rock than simply their birthright, and would be interested in investing. And we have to ensure that we offer an appropriate instrument for that.
Yes, please.
Thank you. Welcome to Washington.
Thank you.
My name is Lynn Hogue. I'm vice president of a company called Strategic Services International. We are a renewable energy manufacturer and developer.
Come to Jamaica.
I was in Jamaica just 3 weeks ago, and we are looking to make some pretty significant investments and working with some of the local companies and sat in on a number of public forums, actually, when I was in country. And one of the major issues is the lack of policy for net metering, the ability for companies to invest in their own generation, allowing the Jamaica Public Service Commission to purchase the energy that would substantiate the investments. And in these public forums, the prognosis was a 2-year process by which some of those policies could be implemented. And just a comment that if those could be accelerated and the investments that our company and others are willing to make and looking at Jamaica as a tremendous resource and investment location would go a long way.
Your point is well taken. We have made significant progress. We have provided the policy framework for net metering, and I'm not a technical person, wheeling and various things. We have provided the policy framework. The utilities regulator is now developing the actual modalities with the single power distribution company that we have. Let me just say two things very quickly, though. We are anxious to support the development of renewable energy. Indeed, we allow for a 15% premium on any new renewable energy source that is brought into being, subject, of course, to a limit. I mean, we have had to put a limit on it of, I think, 15 megawatts. Beyond 15 megawatts, they become commercial operators. We have a successful wind-generating plant, which we've recently expanded from 18 megawatts to 38 megawatts. We're exploring a number of other sites where we believe that that potential exists. We have identified, I think, 10 or 12 of our rivers where we think there is a possibility for small hydro plants. The problem is that in the past, what government has done is that government has gone and invested in these things. And I'm trying to change that game. I'm trying to say, hey, I don't have the money to invest in these things. Can we get some private investors to come and do that? And we will provide you with the policy framework, the incentives, the support, and so on. And net metering is an important part of that. We're having a very important investors conference in October. I'm going to ask my ambassador to just speak with you and make sure that you're there, because it's going to be very important. We're going to showcase these and a whole range of other investment opportunities, and provide them with virtually a roadmap as to as to how to get there and what the prospects are and what the policy support is.
Yes, please. Gentleman in the back.
Thank you. Jose Raul Perales from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Mr. Prime Minister, in light of the implementation of the EPA, many people have begun to wonder whether it's time for the Caribbean to do an upgrade or a significant change to its preferential trade arrangement with the United States. Some people have even proposed the idea of a services-based agreement to move the trade agenda forward. My question to you is whether you believe Jamaica is interested in proposing to the United States or in moving the Caribbean towards a new arrangement with the United States, proposing something that is services-based or some other possible arrangement that would provide a more advanced commercial relationship with the United States. Thank you.
We're proceeding at a pace that we think we can manage. We concluded the negotiations with the European Union back in 2007. We are currently engaged in negotiating a free trade agreement with Canada. Our negotiating capacity is limited because trade negotiations are very complex and we have had to sort of focus our skills in dealing with them virtually one at a time. And we negotiate as a region, as CARICOM. As far as the United States is sort of in queue, but we have appealed to Congress, and Congress has obliged, and the administration has been cooperative in extending the current one-way preferential arrangements to give us some more space in order to complete these negotiations. One final point I want to make on that, however, is this. And it's not something, it's something that I don't feel that Canada and the United States appreciate as much as I think it needs to be appreciated. We are not equals. And therefore, we can't negotiate symmetrical trade agreements where we both operate as if we are equals. There has to be a development component in that trade agreement. In other words, we have to say to our trading partner, you have to commit to investing in developing our capacity to trade. Otherwise, the trade will just be one way. I mean, you will come to us and we will never be able to come to you. In the case of Canada, they say, let's talk about development separately. A trade agreement must just deal with trade. And we say, no, we can't go there. We're using EPA as the template. But we are anxious to even negotiate an agreement with Canada that is EPA plus. The U.S., we haven't got to that stage of discussions yet, but it's going to be important. And if those of you who can exert some influence can help us to persuade the United States that it has to be trade and development, not just trade.
Yeah, we have time for a couple more questions. Gentleman in the back, and the lady in the back as well.
Good morning, Mr. Prime Minister. My name is Adrian Wright, as you're well aware. With the U.S. Department of Transportation's Federal Aviation Administration. In the context of this development question, I'm always cautious about believing anything I read in the newspapers, but there seems to be an idea being generated. Don't know where the catalyst for it came from, but I could hazard a guess. But it addresses our penal system and the fact that the Jamaican government is considering privatization of the penal institutions. Don't know if you're aware of it, but that policy has been an abysmal failure here in the United States. Some people would argue otherwise, but I can tell you from its genesis to now, what has happened is that the United States has now has the distinction of having the most people incarcerated of any industrialized country in the world, including China. That is not a distinction for which one goes around waving either the stars and stripes or, for that matter, the black, green, and the gold. So I guess my question is, are there a paucity of ideas being floated around within and external to Jamaica, because this policy is there's nothing novel here. This has been tried. This has been tested, and its result, as I've said before, is an abysmal failure. We now have over 2 million people incarcerated in the United States of America.
Well, I think your argument is flawed in the sense that I don't know that you can blame privatization for the number of people who are incarcerated. It is not private people who arrest people. They simply manage the custody of those people once they're arrested. I don't know what the American experience has been. I made arrangements with the British government for the director, the Commissioner of Corrections in Jamaica, to visit Britain to see what their experience has been. And I've also made arrangements, but it hasn't happened yet, with the U.S. government for him to visit the U.S. as well. So our jury is still out on that. The fact of the matter is that our prisons are abysmally run. The conditions under which we keep those persons who are convicted in many instances make them worse criminals when they come out, or worse potential criminals when they come out. We spend a lot of money to do that. Now, by our standards, not by your standards, but we spend $1 million to house each prisoner. Now, $1 million is far more than what a family spends looking after each of its children. Many of them spend less. So what we're saying is that we can get better value for that money. And I'm strongly of the view, it's not that government is totally incompetent and inept, but there are certain things that involve a structured management that we feel can be done by private enterprise. I've seen in the case of children's homes, for example, I've seen where private children's homes are run far more efficiently than those that are run by the state at far less cost. And I've thrown it out. We haven't taken a decision on it. But for you to say that it represents a sort of barrenness of ideas, you have one of two options. You either run it yourself or you privatize it. I don't know that there's anything in between.
I agree with you, Mr. Prime Minister.
Yeah.
I just want to thank you first and foremost for offering assistance to people of Haiti that landed in Jamaica.
I'm saying that as a member of the diaspora.
Oh, you are?
And I'm saying, I mean, Jamaica is my home.
Well, maybe you need to come back home and consult with us and give us the benefit of your experience.
So we have one last question in the back.
But thank you for the assisting of the Haitian people.
Thank you.
Hello, Prime Minister. My name is Michelle Benjamin Calhoun. I'm with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And you mentioned certain factors that pertain to agriculture, including the government's movement towards privatizing the sugar industry. You also mentioned the erosion of the historical preferential agreements, the fact that Jamaica's production and export of primary commodities lends a certain degree of vulnerability, and finally that Jamaica must engage effectively in the multilateral trading regime. Given all of that and other forces that impact agriculture, I'd like to know, what is your view on Jamaica's growth and development strategy for agriculture?
Well, privatization is one part of it. Just take sugar, for example. After so many years, Jamaica still plants cane, runs that cane through a grinder, dries it out into raw sugar, and we dump it on a ship and we export it. Our value-added stops very low down the value-added chain. One of the things that we're hoping to see and expect to see from this new investment from the Chinese company, they have all but committed themselves now to building a sugar refinery. Do you know that the entire CARICOM imports all its refined sugar from elsewhere, from Colombia and elsewhere? The last sugar refinery in Trinidad closed 2 years ago. And CARICOM is a captive market, and they have committed $250 million of investment to building a new refinery. So we're seeking to add value. We want to do some more exciting things. Jamaica produces, in terms of its quality, one of the finest chocolates in the world. But the chocolate capital of the world is Belgium. Belgium does not produce a single pot of chocolate. And we just feel that there's value added there, that we can combine sugar, chocolate, the best chocolate in the world. We produce the best ginger in the world. There's so much. But government can't invest in those things. I mean, that has to be private sector. We want to facilitate that. In terms of the development for agriculture, you know, I had a meeting last week with a meeting of the Economic Development Council, and we had a presentation from the Ministry of Agriculture, the minister and his team. And one of the things that I pointed out to them, and it's something that I'm insisting on because some of our thinking is still trapped in the past. There is a notion that agriculture is supposed to be a large employer of labor. You know, almost a sponge to sop up surplus labor. If you look at the countries in the world that are successful in agriculture, you look at Argentina, look at Australia, look at New Zealand, the contribution of agriculture to GDP is way in excess of the percentage of the labor force that it employs. Because agriculture has to be driven by technology. And this notion that for every 100 acres of land, you must employ 200 people. So what we're trying to do is to move agriculture into high tech. We're doing well, but we're still in the early stages. We have introduced greenhouse farming. As a matter of fact, it's running a little too fast for us because it's producing so much stuff now that we're having depression in terms of market prices, and we're looking to try and see if we can crank up agro-processing to take off that surplus. But it has to be highly capital-intensive, high technology-driven, creating the kind of buoyancy in that sector that will allow for investment in other areas that will absorb the labor that it will displace. And that's the way we have to go. It's not, if I say that to a farmers meeting in Jamaica, they will perhaps burn me at the stakes. But the fact of the matter is that that is the way we have to go. Otherwise, we will continue to support a sector that does little more than put a little food on the farmer's table. I want agriculture to be able to make that farmer enjoy a good standard of living, live in a good house, send his children to a good school. But it's not going to be possible if it is overburdened with this mandate, historical mandate, that your job in agriculture is to employ as much labor as possible. It can't work.
Thank you very much, Mr. Prime Minister. Let me try to move the conversation in this last interaction before we close, because the Prime Minister has to leave. We've been talking mostly about Jamaica and the issues of development. Let me try to provoke your reactions on issues that have more of a regional scope, and your views on topics that are important here in Washington that generate interest, like, for example, the reconstruction of Haiti. You already mentioned it in passing. The reforms in Cuba, another country that is close to Jamaica, and also a reflection also on the role of aid and the importance of the United States in that front, but also of countries like Venezuela through programs like Petrocaribe, and how that kind of play an important role in the development of the Caribbean. So I'm just mentioning a few of them for you to select. I mean, not necessarily to mention all of them, but
let me say
on a more regional dimension.
Let me say a word about Cuba. I'm absolutely convinced that Cuba is undergoing transformation. It may not follow the design that some would wish to see. Cuba is not going to proclaim itself to be a democracy in a hurry. But there's no doubt in my mind that changes are taking place. I have had a number of conversations with Raul Castro, and I'm satisfied that he thinks differently from what has obtained in the past. But they're going to do it at their own pace. My own view is that they ought to be engaged. My own view is that the pace at which they move and the things that they do in moving along that pace could be altered if they are engaged. And I still find an incongruity between the engagement of China, which is a declared communist country, the engagement of Vietnam, which is one of the four avowed communist countries. There are only four left. You know, it's Cuba, China, Vietnam, and North Korea. There's a dissonance between that approach and Cuba. And I think some of that has to do with this proximity and the fact that there are Cubans who are alienated from the regime who are pretty powerful here. But I think it's a process that, I mean, who would have thought, for example, that Raul Castro would have announced that he intends to impose term limits not only for his own office, but for all the senior political officers in the country. So that those are things that mustn't, I don't think that we should be cynical about them. I think that we ought to engage. Insofar as Venezuela is concerned, and Venezuela is a source of a great deal of irritation to the United States, and certainly we completely dissociate ourselves from some of the rhetoric. I mean, that famous tirade at the United Nations after President Bush had left the podium is not something that anybody would want to condone. And yet, we're part of the region. Yet Jamaica benefits significantly from the Petro-Carib arrangement. And we have to work with that. And we reserve our position. Jamaica has been consistent in its approach in terms of its insistence on democracy and so on. But we are part of a region. Forgive me for going on so long, but it's important. I think the United States needs to consider seriously whether there is not a vacuum that has been created, perhaps unintentionally, in terms of U.S. involvement in Latin America. Now, that may very well be because it has been preoccupied with so many things. If you look at what happened with the end of the Cold War and the emerging democracies in Central and Eastern Europe, America had to be engaged there to support that effort. You look at all of what has happened since 9/11 and the preoccupation that the United States inescapably had to take on with so many matters having to do with international terrorism. And its focus naturally would have dissipated. The Caribbean and Latin American region no longer poses the kind of political threat as it did during the days of the Cold War. But I don't think that good deeds should be rewarded with neglect or abandonment. President Obama has committed himself to a new engagement with Latin America and the Caribbean. He did so at the summit of the Americas in 2009. And it is something that we are anxious to work with the administration to develop. I had discussions yesterday with Secretary of State Clinton, and it was among the issues that we discussed in specific program areas. But it is something that has to be promoted because we, Caribbean in particular, we are the United States' third border. And we feel that it's a border that must be given attention in the same way that the other two are, because I think that in the long term we are important. We are an important part of the neighborhood.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you, Prime Minister. It's been a splendid occasion, and I want to invite the audience to join me in expressing our gratitude for your time.